From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The U.S. stock market sank this morning as China imposed $75 billion of tariffs on American-made goods. On CNN White House economic advisor Peter Navarro downplayed the effect on the economy.
We don't run around the West Wing with anxiety. We look at the chessboard and we see basically a strong Trump economy growing at 2% because of tax cuts, deregulation, cheap energy, and trade.
Meanwhile, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton became the latest Democrat to drop out of the presidential race. And that's where we're going to pick up our Friday Politics Roundtable. Meg Kennard is national politics reporter for the Associated Press. She's based in the all-important state of South Carolina. Hi, Meg.
Hello.
And Aisha Roscoe, White House reporter for NPR. Aisha, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And let's start with you, Aisha. Seth Moulton drops out of the primary race this morning, telling the Washington Post that veering too far to the left could lose Democrats the election. Of course, earlier this week, Jay Inslee of Washington State, the governor there, and John Hickenlooper also said goodbye to their bid. What does the thinning of this field tell us about the 2020 state of play right now?
Well, it says that this field was extremely large to begin with, and it continues to be large. So it's inevitable that you're going to have this kind of falling away and with candidates who just weren't able to gain traction. And right now, Seth Moulton was a more moderate candidate. And I know that he's warning about going to the left. But so far, a lot of the moderate candidates haven't been able to get that attention and to get up in the polls other than Joe Biden,
right,
who is in the lead. And so there is a question of where the party is going to go and whether it's going to go more to the center or more to the left. But some of these candidates that are kind of more on the outside of these polls are not going to be the ones to determine that.
Well, and Meg, there's a deadline coming up next week to qualify for the September debates in Houston. Do you have a sense that voters are eager to see some of these candidates drop out and that they're sort of ready to hear from a narrower field?
Absolutely. There are so many candidates that we've all been covering, following, listening to, learning up on. Voters that I talk to around here at a myriad of events seem kind of exhausted at this point. And this is in an early state. So in South Carolina, we've been seeing the campaign in full swing now since the beginning of this year. But there is a definite sense among the voters who are the interested ones already, the ones that are coming out to these early events, to say, okay, I feel like I'm learning up, I'm getting to know some of the field, but there's just too many of them really to decide with whom I really feel that I'm going to align when it comes down to who to vote for in the eventual primary next year. So, yes, there is a definite need, a yearning, I think, in the Democratic electorate to get down to a couple of candidates who are going to be the ones who can meet those benchmarks, who can get on the debate stage, who can sustain fundraising to get through the third quarter of this year, which I think people kind of look at as a soft deadline, really, of, okay, if you can really muster the strength to come out of the third quarter with strong numbers, then that may be enough to carry you into the first part of next year when we do actually have voting that begins.
Mm-hmm. Meg and Aisha, I want to go back to Joe Biden. Aisha, you mentioned him being in the lead. There was a Post and Courier poll in South Carolina this month that showed Joe Biden with a 19-point lead over his remaining rivals in the Democratic primary. And we've also seen that there's been talk in Iowa that folks aren't that really excited. They aren't that excited to meet with Biden or vote for him. What has been the talk in South Carolina and in Iowa? Both of you weigh in on that.
Well, I think part of the issue when you look at the reporting out of Iowa on Biden is that he has strong support, but that the support is based in this idea of electability and that he will be the person that can beat Trump. And that's been a lot of what he's been running on. But people don't feel as much of a personal connection to him or a personal connection to the ideas that he's pushing, unlike an Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. And so that is something that he has to try to overcome, in a sense, that he needs to show, like, I am someone who can be passionate about not just the fact that I can beat Trump, but also about my policy ideas.
Meg, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. The question of, do I like Joe Biden? Do I know him? Am I accustomed to what I think are his policy positions? That's something that a lot of voters are feeling that they already have an answer to, because, you know, there's a large sense, a large identification that they put with Joe Biden going back to the Obama administration and in some ways before. But especially in places like South Carolina, this is a place, as that polling that you just mentioned shows, where Joe Biden does have a very high number. Now, that number, according to which polls you're looking at, he's not gaining in that respect, mm-hmm. right? And that's the problem with being a front runner in many aspects. You do have the biggest number, but your number generally does not go up so much as other people raise name ID, mm-hmm. as they raise more money, as they spend more time out in the field, letting voters get to know them and vice versa. For Joe Biden, though, he has focused very strongly a lot of his assets and resources in South Carolina. This is a place where he has come personally to vacation. He spent a lot of time here. He had longstanding relationships with two of the state's very senior senators, Strom Thurmond and Fritz Hollings, mm-hmm. at one point.
Which was controversial. Yeah.
It was, yeah. Exactly. But he's a known commodity here and has had a very long relationship here. So just recently, this past week, he came out with the announcement that he had been endorsed by more than three dozen African-American pastors here. We don't really write a whole lot about each and every endorsement that comes out, but for Joe Biden, that is a definite show of strength in terms of what he's willing to really, you know, put into his campaign here and who he's really talking to.
Ayesha, let's take a minute to talk about Bernie Sanders, who unveiled a $16 trillion plan to address climate change yesterday. It would phase out fossil fuels over the next 30 years. Here's Sanders.
Researchers are telling us that if we do not get our act together, California's entire agricultural economy, an economy that feeds much of this country, could be in serious danger.
Ayesha, his progressive supporters will cheer this plan, but it is remarkably expensive. Do you think this is a liability for moderates in a primary and later on during a general election?
It is something that this whole idea of how to deal with climate change is something that Democrats have to figure out how to kind of thread that needle, because it is something that calls for expansive action. When you look at climate change, it is a global issue. It deals with the very fabrics of society and how we heat our homes. How do we get around all of these issues? So it's going to take a lot to deal with it. But people also don't like it when you talk about dealing with climate change and say you may have to pay more, your taxes may go up, you will have to change some of the things that you find convenient. So trying to figure out how do you make that message, especially in a way where it cannot be so easily demonized, mm-hmm. by Republicans, and that may not be possible, but how do you make that message to the take that message to the voters?
For both of you, I'd like to know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, there's been lots of criticism, but that they are so similar. How do you all see themselves differentiating themselves? Because right now they're splitting the progressive vote by about the same margin that Joe Biden is ahead of them in the polls. Meg?
In South Carolina, where they both actually spent time here last week, over the weekend, and I got a chance to catch up with both of them, there is a lot of interest in both candidacies. Elizabeth Warren's numbers and some recent polling that we've seen come out of South Carolina, she's been gaining, and that comes in part as she continues to get to know people better and do exactly what we were talking about earlier, just spend more time in the electorate. Bernie Sanders ran here, you know, in 2016, so he does have that name ID. He does have kind of a sense of familiarity among the electorate across the country, but especially in these early voting states. But at this point in the game, voters are just really starting to pay attention. I think we'll see that happen more in the fall. Mm-hmm. So when they're trying to think and contrast and look at these two candidacies, in part, if they do have a perception of what they think Bernie Sanders stands for, that may go back to what they remember from 2016, mm-hmm. which was a very different campaign, which didn't have nearly the choice. He was the only candidate in that race who really kind of represented that progressive lane. And now there are more options. So it is going to come down to a very much more nuanced sense if voters are thinking that they might be picking between the two. But both of them here are getting a lot of attention. They're drawing a lot of voters out. And no one really seems to have definitively made up their minds whom they're going to support, but it looks like they're shopping certainly between the two.
Well, look, the nature of this primary season is that we just can't get to all the candidates, and I do want to switch over to the Republican side because President Trump may not be running alone soon. Former Illinois Congressman and conservative radio host Joe Walsh may decide any day now whether he's going to run. Also, former South Carolina Congressman Mark Sanford says he's getting green lights when he talks to people in New Hampshire. There's also Bill Weld, but we haven't heard too much from him. What does this mean for the president? Clearly, he's a shoo-in to win the nomination, but what would primary challengers mean, Aisha?
I don't know that it means too much for President Trump because, if nothing else, he has cemented his support with his base and he and with the Republican Party. He and the Republican Party are one at this point. There really isn't any room or any space between them. And so people can come out and they'll get some attention, I think, and they can. But it likely wouldn't be from people who would be voting for Republicans, right? Like, yeah. they may get some attention from some more liberal voters.
All right. Aisha Roscoe, White House reporter for NPR. We've also been talking to Meg Kinnard, national politics reporter at the Associated Press. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The night before his first scene with Catherine O'Hara, Dan Levy was a little freaked out.
This is my first time acting since a Lifetime movie that I did with Misha Barton.
The stories behind the celebrities. Every Tuesday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
It's something none of us wants to think about, but what could you do to save lives in the frantic moments after, say, a shooting or a car accident? A campaign called Stop the Bleed is an effort aimed at getting people trained and equipped in a bleeding emergency before help arrives. Dr. Matt Levy is chairman of the Stop the Bleed Coalition, and he joins us from Maryland. Dr. Levy, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for taking the time to talk about this such an important topic.
How did this idea come about? How of regular citizens being equipped to help?
Stop the Bleed got its roots around 2013, 2014, and there are a variety of factors that got us to this point. But one of the most important things were the lessons learned from the military on the battlefield about how survival can be improved if everyone knew how to recognize and intervene upon severe bleeding.
How does it work?
What we want people to be able to do is we want them to know what severe bleeding looks like and what those signs and symptoms are. And if they see someone bleeding, what severe bleeding might represent in terms of someone who's confused or who appears like they may be going into shock, someone who has a severe injury like an amputation. And we want people to recognize those types of severe bleeding emergencies and not be afraid to help. We want them to recognize it, to alert or activate the 911 system as soon as possible, and to do something until help arrives. And that something is to compress that wound.
Okay, so people are trained through Stop the Bleed. Can you give us one example of some techniques when you're out there and maybe you're encountering someone who is bleeding?
Yes. So one of the first and most important things someone can do when they encounter someone who's bleeding is apply pressure to that wound. The Stop the Bleed campaign and the Stop the Bleed initiative, the icon is a stop sign with a hand in the middle, and that's not by accident. That's because we want people to know that if they apply pressure with their hands, they can slow down or even stop severe bleeding.
Should we be also using a tourniquet to do that as well, or is that something that's a little more advanced?
So the Stop the Bleed training does include how to use equipment such as a tourniquet to effectively control life-threatening bleeding. What we want people to know is that all bleeding will stop with pressure, and then it becomes a discussion of how do we effectively maintain and continue that pressure. So if the bleeding is on an arm or a leg, and we can get the tourniquet fully around and above or closer to the central portion of the body, or what we would say closer to the heart, we would want to apply that tourniquet. If the bleeding is on a part of the body that we can't get a tourniquet around, then we really have to focus on maintaining and holding pressure.
Is there anything else that you can add to that, like another thing that someone could do?
Yes, it is really important that when people call 911 and they access the 911 system, that they give as much information to that 911 operator as possible. I've listened to 911 calls over the years where time to getting our responders and our professional rescuers to the scene is delayed because we can't really clarify where the injured person is. So when we call 911, it's so important that the caller gives as much detail as possible, where specifically they are.
I've always been taught if someone is hurting, if they've been in an accident or something like that, that you should leave them alone. You should not touch them. You should contact authorities and let those folks who are the experts handle it. This is kind of the opposite of that. But tell me what those few moments mean when it comes to, yeah, I guess, life and death.
Yeah, so someone can bleed to death from a severely bleeding injury in as little as several minutes, 3 to 5 minutes. And even in our most well-designed and most sophisticated emergency response systems, it can take that long or much longer in some cases for our professional rescuers to get there. And so during that period of time, as blood is being lost, the body could go into a state of shock or the person could even bleed to death.
You're an ER doctor, a former paramedic. Talk about those moments and how important those few moments are in saving someone's life. I'm sure you've gone on countless calls where you've gotten to the scene, and perhaps if someone were there to assist before you got there, could that have meant the difference?
Yeah, and I'll be very honest with you. I get a chill down my spine when I'm asked this question, because I get asked this question a lot. And indeed, there have been cases and calls I've been on where if someone would have done something sooner, the outcome could have been different. Increasingly and more excitingly, more and more, our paramedics are arriving on scene and someone is doing good care and someone has started this process already. So I believe that there is opportunity for us to turn this tide and to empower the lay public and those there at time of injury to do more about this. And if it's not perfect, that's okay. But what we want to do is kind of turn the odds in the patient's favor of survival.
That's Dr. Matt Levy. He is the chairman of Stop the Bleed Coalition. He teaches basic bleeding control techniques, and we'll have more information on Stop the Bleed training on our website, hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, doctor.
Thank you.
Some of the OWN Network's biggest hits have been soapy dramas like Greenleaf and shows from Tyler Perry. But earlier this month, the channel, which is owned by Oprah Winfrey, began airing a new drama called David Makes Man. It's about a smart, ambitious high school student navigating his life in a poor Miami housing project. The show is created by playwright Terrell Alvin McCraney, whose work inspired the Oscar-winning film Moonlight. In fact, one reviewer described the new show as Moonlight meets The Wire. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching, and he joins us now to discuss. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
David Makes Man follows David, who is attending a school on a scholarship, and he struggles to balance life at this mostly white school and his poor neighborhood where a drug gang controls the area around his family's apartment. Here's a clip of David, played by Akili McDowell, complaining to his mentor about being sent to the principal's office for getting into a fight with another student. Let's take a listen.
Look, I know you feel bad. You saw red. You thought somebody close to you was trying to stand in your way. That's the world, G. Sometimes you gotta hit him up.
I didn't hit him.
There you go.
I made him hit me.
That's better?
No, they got me seeing the school psychologist.
Well, get her to see that you're one of the good ones. Get her to see that you're exceptional.
What is this show trying to say about the pressure to be exceptional?
Well, this show is all about all the unique pressures that make a coming-of-age story for a young black man different than coming-of-age stories for other people. In particular, it's about code switching. It's about this idea that you present yourself in a different way, you speak in a different way, you react in a different way in different cultural environments. So he's constantly having to act one way in his neighborhood and in the housing project where he lives, and he has to act another way when he's at school. And the question is, like, what's his true face? Like, when you're constantly switching and performing in a way for the people around you so you fit in, who are you really deep down? And that's what this entire piece is really about.
Critics have been saying that this show has a level of complexity not seen since HBO's The Wire. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, The Wire is a show that ultimately is about systems. Like David Simon, the guy who created it, wanted to create a show that would talk about how no matter what your intentions are, no matter how good a cop you are, no matter how good a person you are, if you get caught up in the system of policing or the system of the drug war or the system of the drug distribution and selling system in poor black neighborhoods, it's hard to escape the effects of that system. And so he's about systems. David Makes Man is about the journey of a particular young man, someone who's very intelligent, but somebody who's also kind of trapped in poverty. He's trapped in the social systems of the neighborhood that he lives in. And he's also, in a way, confined by the expectations for him when he goes to this other school. We see how much he's struggling to figure out, like, who am I? Mm. And how do I get to that ideal person from where I am now? And it's a unique kind of story that I don't think we've seen told in quite this way.
This show is deeply personal for the playwright Terrell Alvin McCraney. He grew up in Miami. As we said, he wrote the play that inspired Moonlight. And you spoke with him at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention in Miami earlier this month. Let's listen to what he told you about racism.
If we are constantly trying to get people who do not understand us, do not believe us to be human, to recognize us, what we are ultimately doing at the end of the day is falling into racism's most primal weapon, which is to frustrate us into proving ourselves all the time. The great late Toni Morrison always talked about that's what racism's primal function is, to make us constantly have to prove that we're worthy.
Mm. This idea of having to prove yourself, a big part of his struggle.
Yeah. You know, David is facing this because he has to prove that even though he's really smart and he attends this, you know, school, that in his neighborhood, he can't be taken advantage of. And so he's constantly trying to prove himself to all these different people, which is why he's code switching so much. When McCraney talked during the NABJ convention, he talked a lot about code switching and how it helps disguise sometimes who we are even from ourselves. And he wanted to create a show that would sort of speak to that.
Winfrey's network has tended to produce more female-centric shows. I know them. Some of them are my favorites. How does this offering compare to the rest of what's on that network?
Well, it's interesting. This channel has had an evolution. I think it started out with a lot of shows, frankly, that didn't speak to Oprah Winfrey's core constituency. And this David Makes Man feels like it's an expansion of that. You know, it's a creatively ambitious show. It feels a little bit like an indie film that was turned into a TV show. And it's trying to speak to themes that I think black women can relate to, the struggles of their sons. And it'll be interesting to see how this show resonates with OWN's core viewership.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Thank you so much, Eric.
Always a pleasure.
And now for an update to what feels like an endless battle against robocalls. Major telecommunications companies, including AT&T, Sprint, and Verizon, are teaming up with the attorneys general of all 50 states, plus Washington, D.C., to stop our phones from ringing nonstop. Included in that deal is more call blocking and call labeling technology for customers, and increased public-private cooperation in tracing calls back to their source. Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge was one of the leaders of the agreement. She announced it in Washington, D.C. yesterday, and she joined me earlier today from the airport as she headed back home. Hello, Attorney General Rutledge.
Good morning. Glad to be on with you. And robocalls are driving everyone up the wall.
They are. They are. I just received two this morning.
Indeed. And they cost our elderly their life savings because, unfortunately, these con artists are so good. And unfortunately, people lose thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yes. So with that, can you tell us a little bit more about this agreement? And really, more importantly, how this agreement will make sure that these telecommunications companies follow through with making certain that people aren't targeted in this way?
Well, the important part of this agreement is that we are, you know, as phone companies and phone providers sign on, it's important that every phone provider, every carrier be engaged and sign on so that way we can trace back these calls. Because when a call originates out of country and it comes to a telephone, whether it's in Manhattan or in Little Rock, Arkansas, then it goes through many carriers. Many different phone companies or carriers transmit that phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And we need everyone to use the technology that's available so that way we can track that phone call and it be tagged so we can go back to where it was originated and to hold that person, that company accountable. Legitimate businesses are not making these robocalls. These are criminals, and that's why the Do Not Call list do not work.
So with all of them working together on this, there's more of a coordinated effort to make certain that these calls won't be able to get through.
Again, it's as if we are passing a baton. That phone call is the baton that goes through the system. And so to have all of these phone providers engaged, it's going to take the private industry to be engaged. Unfortunately, government, we just don't have the technology and resources to go after the bad actors.
We're talking about all of the attorneys general on board for this. That seems remarkable. How hard was it to pull it all together?
Well, this is something that every single attorney general and every single state people are frustrated with. And so this is one of our largest complaints. So when we have something of this magnitude that's impacting America, it's attorneys general. We don't care if you're a Republican, Democrat. We all work together for the good of the people in our respective states.
When can we expect to see these changes receive less robocalls?
It won't be immediately, like it's going to shut down tomorrow. But as they sign on these new agreements with their carriers, then we will start seeing less robocalls over time. But I'm hoping that we're sending the message to these criminals that we're going to use everything in our power to stop you from making these calls. This will put even more pressure on Congress to pass legislation to ensure our phone companies are adhering to this, as well as encouraging the Federal Communication Commission and the Federal Trade Commission. They've been great partners, but to do even more to stop this and to protect American savings accounts and their life fortunes.
Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge, one of 50 attorneys generals plus the District of Columbia, announcing a new deal to eradicate robocalls. Thank you so much, Attorney General Rutledge.
Thank you, Tonya. Have a great day.
Four hundred years ago this month, the first Africans arrived on slave ships in the British colonies of North America. In late August 1619, about 20 people captured in present-day Angola were brought to a port in Virginia called Point Comfort and sold into slavery. The site later became home to Fort Monroe and a Union-held refuge for slaves during the Civil War. President Obama declared it a national monument in 2011.
This is going to give an opportunity for people from all across the country to travel to Fort Monroe and trace the history that has been so important to making America what it is.
The National Park Service has planned a series of events this weekend to mark the occasion, and Agena Quezon Rogers will be there. She's a National Park Ranger with a personal connection to the fort's history. Agena, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And first, tell me about this place. Fort Monroe is not only where the slave trade began in what is now the United States, but it's also where slavery started its decline.
That's correct. In 1861, in May of 1861, General Butler was there, and three enslaved men had escaped from working for the Confederacy, and he made a decision that since they were considered property by the Confederate owners there, they were contraband. And therefore, they were considered property that could be seized. But they were starting to experience a type of freedom, and my family, many of them on my mom's side, the Fields family, eventually followed in the footsteps of these men and these other people who had been enslaved and came to Fort Monroe seeking freedom.
So that was at the dawn of the Civil War, and I want to hear a lot more about your ancestor, James Apostle Fields. But let's take a step back and go to 1619, the earliest days of slavery. Tell me more about that time and the people who suffered under slavery then.
Mm-hmm. Well, those who arrived first in Virginia came after having been seized from Africa and brought over. you can imagine how difficult that was. And also to have your name taken away and your freedom taken away. And eventually in Virginia, it becomes something that's passed down from generation to generation. But what is so beautiful about the stories that we tell or the way we look at these times now is that you also bring out the resilience of a people who were able, in spite of all the repression and oppression that was put upon them, they were able to continue to create families and bring the culture that had been remembered from various places that they came from in Africa. And that becomes incorporated into this American nation. So when we look at 1619, we look at it as the beginning of various cultures, the European culture, the African culture, and the Native American culture coming together to create the American culture we have today.
Well, speaking of resilience, your great-great-grandfather, James Apostle Fields, who spent time at Fort Monroe, had just an absolutely remarkable life. What can you tell me about him?
He certainly did. James Apostle Fields was my great-great-grandfather. And at the age of 17, he escaped slavery. He had been born in Hanover County.
In Virginia.
In Virginia, Hanover County, Virginia. In fact, I live about 5 miles today from where he had been enslaved. When I first moved back to Virginia, I took my little daughter to the Hanover courthouse and stood there and just thought, wow, how 150 years later I could be there proudly and come on my own to be where he had been enslaved.
Wow.
But what had happened is that he had a very cruel master who beat him severely. And that at that point, he decided to take his freedom. And through the network of people in the area, he was able to escape and live free for about 6 months. But then he was captured again. However, on the way back to Hanover, he took his freedom one more time, ran through rebel lines, and ended up with the Union Army in the Union camp. And with that, he served as a scout until 1864, when he makes his way to Fort Monroe, where his mother, Martha Ann Fields, and his brothers and sisters had also escaped to their freedom.
He later becomes part of the first graduating class at Hampton University. He was elected to the Virginia House of Delegates. How do you think he was able to overcome so many hurdles in the 1860s and the 1880s? How did he do that?
He was just determined, and he had a strong mother who encouraged all of her children to strive to do the one thing that could help them get to a higher level, and that was to get an education. That's why he was in the first class of Hampton. That is why he worked in the House of Delegates as the doorkeeper. And eventually, because he had been exposed to what lawyers were doing and saw that, he himself went off to Howard University and got his law degree. Hmm. He even serves for 8 years as Commonwealth's attorney in Warwick County. Serves in the House of Delegates, was one of the last African Americans to serve in the House of Delegates until the 1960s.
Because during Reconstruction, right after the Civil War, black men were commonly elected to public office, and then the era of Jim Crow comes, and there wouldn't be another black man serving in the House of Delegates for 75 years.
Yes,
it's amazing.
Yeah, and so that story was passed down to us to help us as Fields descendants to remember that education was a way to keep on pushing forward. And we were always encouraged to do our best. And so my son, Joseph Rogers, will be portraying James Fields this weekend at the program for the Hampton 400.
So now this country is 400 years removed from the first slave ships arriving here. How are you reflecting upon that milestone right now? What's on your mind?
What's on my mind now with this commemoration is that this has been a journey for all who are living here in the United States. it's time for us to reflect on that journey and how it affects us so that we can understand where each person is coming from. If you look at the individual stories, that's when you find the humanity. When you start generalizing or dehumanizing someone, you can easily put them in a box and say their story doesn't matter. But when we start coming face to face and sharing our individual stories, that's when we can really make this country what it should be and what it has always strived to be.
But four centuries later, here we are still witnessing violence against people of color. Just look at the massacre in El Paso a few weeks ago, targeting Latino people. There was the deadly protest in Charlottesville, Virginia, not far from where you are.
Not far from where we are.
Why is that legacy still so deeply ingrained into our society even today?
The legacy of slavery and segregation is deeply ingrained even today because of how you experience life. You only know what you know. And until you are exposed to a different set of people, you won't know what their story is. Someone looks at the color of your skin and thinks that you are those stereotypes that were perpetuated, particularly, for example, during Jim Crow segregation. And Jim Crow, that blacks were shuffling, lazy, ignorant. If that's the only thing that you've been exposed to, that's what you're going to react to. So that's why it's deeply ingrained. There's a fear of the other that we have to work through. And you need to make sure that people know the struggles that have come before.
Well, Ajina Quezon Rogers, thank you for exposing us to your family's story. Your great-great-grandfather sought refuge from slavery during the Civil War at Fort Monroe, the same place where slavery began in the colony of Virginia 400 years ago this month. Ajina, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Dina Castor is one of the best distance runners in American history. She has major marathon wins in Chicago and London. And 15 years ago this week, she captured a bronze medal when she finished third in the 2004 Olympic marathon in Athens. But that success took more than physical training. Castor had to change the way she approached the sport mentally. In 2018, she spoke to Here and Now's Alex Ashlock about her book, Let Your Mind Run, a memoir of thinking my way to victory. It's now out on paperback.
I started running when I was 11 years old and stumbled on it after failing miserably at so many other sports. I played soccer on my dad's soccer team and running around the field like a swarm of bees with the other kids and finally scored a goal, but it happened to be for the other team because I didn't realize we switched directions at the halftime. We moved on to softball where it was terribly boring and I would rather make dandelion necklaces in the outfield than have anything to do with the bat and ball that's required. And furthermore, I don't have much coordination, which was very apparent after I moved into ice skating. So at the point where my parents were trying to put me in sports to boost my self-esteem, to give me people to look up to in various sports, it was crushing my self-esteem until I found running. I was let loose into the Santa Monica Mountains on the first day of practice, and I never wanted to turn back. It was just this love affair of exploration and joy of the twists and turns and the rattlesnakes and the brush and the smells, aromas of licorice and sage and eucalyptus. It was just heaven from the very first day.
You had that joy in running right from the very beginning. You write in the book about feeling joy when you're out running even today. But there was also a struggle in your running because you were in some ways motivated by fear of losing.
I had a pretty good running streak when I was younger, and constantly after races, parents and coaches telling me that I was talented. And when you hear that enough, I think you subconsciously lose the connection between training and performance. And so that was never clear to me. And I ended up losing a lot more in college. And once I felt defeated and frustrated and thinking that the person with the most talent is winning, and that's not me. So maybe I'm burnt out. Maybe I used up all of my talent resources and thought maybe it was time to move on from the sport.
Yeah, you were going to quit.
Absolutely. And I think I just felt frustrated and defeated. And when you're running with anxiety and tension, your body's not operating at its best. So I was injury prone and in a cycle of injuries and desperately wanted to get away from it.
What brought you back to it?
Luckily, I had conversations with other coaches that knew that they hadn't seen the best of me, knew that I had a fire in me when I started college, and it seemed to fade out towards the end, and that maybe I just needed a change of environment. And it landed me with a phone conversation with Coach Joe Vigil in Colorado, and in 5 minutes, he completely unraveled everything I knew about running. He never mentioned talent or winning. Everything in his vocabulary was about adaptation, training principles, living an athlete's lifestyle. With just a week prior, I thought, I've been running all my life, and I want to try something new. And right there, I thought, I've been running my whole life, and I know nothing about what makes this sport. I don't know why I lose and why I win. And I set out to discover that, trying to make the best choices. So I packed my bags immediately and moved out to be with Coach Vigil, because I knew under him I could have the growth that I was seeking.
And did that also bring the joy back?
It absolutely did. I think the joy was brought back the second I felt potential build in me, that I stopped thinking that I was burnt out and defeated, to feeling like, wow, I have so much to learn and so much to grow upon.
Did your work with Coach Vigil, did that help you deal with the setbacks?
Absolutely. I think the whole point in my book, Let Your Mind Run, was trying to show that mental evolution of the past 2 decades of my career, how as soon as I started looking at how a shift in my thinking could shift the physical effort that I was in, instead of don't give up, I changed it to maintain contact. And when my mind was in don't give up, when that was my mantra in my head, I was just fading off this pack. And as soon as I realized I was using negative words, don't and give up, I switched it to maintain contact, because that's actually what I wanted out of my body. And by telling my body what I wanted it to do, not what I didn't want it to do, I felt a complete energy shift in my body, and I pulled forward and latched back onto the group ahead of me. So these were discoveries that were so profound. And then we moved to gratitude lists and imagery and positive affirmations and all these things that were transforming my running in such a big way, but in the end ended up transforming me and enabling me to really deal with setbacks in running a lot more easier, and also in life.
So these are life lessons in addition to being running lessons, and they could apply to ordinary runners, ordinary people who aren't Olympic medalists.
That was my intention in writing, not to write a memoir so people could learn more about me, but more of an instructional memoir so people could discover more about themselves.
Dina Castor speaking with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. You can read an excerpt of her book, Let Your Mind Run, a memoir of thinking my way to victory, at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.